Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday, the 17th of August, 2022, and this is Reconstruction, the Construction Index podcast with David Taylor and Phil Bishop, back after a scorching summer break. Have you cooled down yet, Phil?
Not much. I mean, it's still mid-low 20s here, which is nice enough. I mean, not scorching, but it's nice. We might be interrupted by thunder and lightning in the background as I speak.
Okay.
It keeps being promised, but it's not happened yet. And, well, we only ever seem to talk about the weather on this podcast at the outset, so I think let's have a good long conversation about the weather, shall we, David, since it seems to be the story?
Well, there's plenty to talk about, yeah. I mean, we've had the most unusual August so far, haven't we? I'm down here in Devon. August is usually a really big disappointment. People come down here for their summer holidays expecting it to be hot and sunny, and August is usually a wet month. And although it has been raining a little bit here, as I don't need to tell anybody that it hasn't been raining an awful lot for the last 2 or 3 weeks. Yeah, record temperatures, over 40 degrees on the eastern side of the country, and over 33 degrees here. I don't know, how hot did it get there in Kent?
We had more than that. I don't know what the highest was, but I think we hit sort of 38, 39 on the odd occasion. But we're not particularly, I don't think, today going to talk about heat resilience. I mean, we could talk about that and whether buildings, how building design should take account of thermal insulation and the importance of that. I'd like to talk today more about the topics of, firstly, of drought, and secondly, I think that in a few days' time we're warned that we're likely to be seeing floods around the place, because of course there's going to be these storms, or some people have already had them, and the ground is so baked and concretey that it's not going to absorb any of the water that's going to come down. And one article in the papers is saying, carry all your most important possessions upstairs, everyone. We're all going to, build an ark now.
God, that's pretty doom laden. That's one of the problems. And I noticed in the national press, there's been a few things about this over the last couple of days. You know, everybody seems puzzled, or we're supposed to be puzzled, apparently, by this fact that after so much hot, dry weather with the ground being parched, a relatively small amount of rain could actually cause some flooding. But I think anybody in the construction industry who knows anything about sort of flood resilience will understand that when you've got hot, dry, parched ground, when it's baked so hard, it doesn't absorb rainfall particularly well. You need a bit of pre-wetting in order for it to soak away quickly. And so, of course, what happens is that you've got this baked hard ground suddenly deluged with water, which just runs off. And of course, yeah, it's funny that we're talking about a drought now, because in the past we've been speaking about floods and summer flooding, and flooding year round actually has been a bit of a fixture now, hasn't it? We're quite used to seeing exceptional floods in various parts of the country due to the exceptional weather we're having. And it does seem ironic, but not entirely unforeseen, that after a drought like this, if we get a lot of rain, we will get flooding again.
And this is, of course, a construction story, because it's up to the construction industry to mitigate the impact.
Of course.
There are various angles here. I mean, the water companies are not fixing their leaky pipes. They're leaking gazillions of litres. I mean, wasting gazillions of litres of perfectly good water through leaky pipes.
Yeah.
Water privatisation was supposed to fix the infrastructure and palpably hasn't. I mean, that's not worked.
No.
Then there's the whole question of whether we should be, building houses and buildings with rainwater harvesting built in, so that we're using water rather than letting it run to waste, using it more effectively. Hmm. And then there's a whole issue of do we build more reservoirs to capture all this heavy rain that comes down, so we don't flood places that we don't want flooding, and we don't have droughts quite so rapidly because we've got more reservoirs. So there's quite a few angles there to unpick.
Oh God, yeah. I mean, it's a very complicated situation, really. The point about reservoirs I found a bit puzzling because earlier this week I saw a couple of stories on the, I think, BBC website, people saying, you know, we should have been building reservoirs. You know, why haven't we been building reservoirs? And Sir John Armitt, who's the boss of the Infrastructure Commission, has been quoted quite widely in the national press about saying, yeah, we should ignore the NIMBYs. If they don't want a reservoir nearby, that's just too bad. We've got to look after the national infrastructure. And he's right, of course. We can't ignore major, significant and essential infrastructure like water supply just because the people who live nearby the facility which is going to provide it object. But this is the first time I've heard anybody say we should be building more reservoirs. I don't think I've ever heard anybody say that. So I think it's a bit disingenuous to say we've been calling for more reservoirs for years, because I don't really think people have.
Oh, no, they have. I mean, Thames Water, for example, have been trying to build a new reservoir near Abingdon in Oxfordshire for decades. And there's a public inquiry in 2010. Chucked out the plan. The inquiry found the reservoir wasn't fit for purpose, wasn't needed, other alternatives hadn't been properly explored, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And Thames Water have not entirely given up on this. And this is this Abingdon reservoir is particularly the one that Sir John Armitt was talking about.
Right.
And I'm quite glad to see John Armitt speaking out on these issues, because the whole point when the National Infrastructure Commission was set up, and I can't remember when it was set up, but that might have been about 2010, something like that, was rather hopefully or ambitiously or naively, I would say, designed to take the politics out of these big infrastructure projects, things like power stations and reservoirs. You're inevitably going to have local people against, and despite it being in the national interest. And governments being run by politicians year after year run scared of doing unpopular things, even though they're in the national interest by and large. And so that's why major infrastructure takes so long to build and so long to get through planning. And the National Infrastructure Commission was supposed to say, never mind the little local difficulties. Here's the national big picture, regardless of politics. This is what we need as a nation. And this is fundamentally, it's Armitt's job to say, sorry, but we need reservoirs, omelette and eggs. Yeah. You know, we're going to have to do it. And the thing is, reservoirs, unlike a power station or a motorway or HS2 mm-hmm. or something, to my mind, there's no argument that when it's built, okay, it's going to take a long time, but when it's built, you're actually left with a more pleasing and a more eco-friendly environment than when you started. Mm. An almost unique a piece of infrastructure in that regard, I think.
Well, it becomes an amenity, doesn't it? And I mean, I don't... near you, I know of a couple, Buell Bridge, I think that's near you, isn't it?
Buell Bow Waters Beach, which yes. is... Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and Bow Beach, which is near where I used to live. And they're both very popular. General amenities, bird watching. I don't know about fishing. Yeah, probably fishing, but sailing, water sports, that kind of thing.
Even if you don't use them actively to paddle on or swim in or whatever, but it's a visual enhancement, and it stops any bugger building a new town on it.
Yeah.
So from a NIMBY point of view,
that's true.
If you could click your fingers and have it there immediately, I mean, obviously there'd be concerns for people whose own particular land or property was being flooded out. But if it was in a neighbouring area, I'd be all for it. Except we have got this, I don't know how long does it take to build a reservoir, probably a decade or something of, you know, heavy lorries, muck shifting going on. So there would be the construction disruption.
But that's a short term disruption.
Not that short.
Yes.
I mean, it's medium term.
Yes, I suppose so. I mean, obviously, it involves a lot of muck shifting, so that doesn't mean some work, but it's a one-off, isn't it? I mean, it'll happen, and then that's it. There was another story. Was it a recent story? I think it probably was, about this new reservoir, which has actually got the go-ahead. It got the go-ahead last year down near Portsmouth, the Havant Thicket Reservoir. Predictably, that's come up against a bit of local opposition, but that's going ahead, isn't it?
And I think it's quite modest in size compared to the Abingdon proposal. I mean, the East Havant one is something like, you know, less than 1 kilometre by 1.5 kilometre in size, something like that, I think.
Yeah,
1.6 kilometres by 0.8, 800 metres. Abingdon would be several times the size of that if it ever happened.
But
that seems to have, it seems to have come a little bit stalled. The last time I reported anything on that specifically was May 21, when three contractors were shortlisted to build it, and four contractors shortlisted to build the pipelines. And it was, the contract was at that time expected to be awarded in March. And here we are in August, April, May, June, July, August, 5 months after that. As far as I know, and I had a little hoke around on Portsmouth Water, they're the company concerned, Portsmouth Water's website, to see if I've missed anything. And there's been no formal announcement on who's got the contracts, which suggests delay there.
Yeah.
So whether that ever happens.
There was, I found a little story. I only really read the headline because there's a paywall on this website, and I'm not going to pay just to read one story. It's a local newspaper in Hampshire. Serious concerns raised amid plans to discharge recycled sewage into the future Havant Thicket Reservoir, which I don't know. It sounds like a typical local newspaper story to me. By recycled sewage,
that means clean water, isn't it?
I guess that's probably clean water, yeah. Yes, probably the water produced by a very expensive water treatment works.
I was going to say, someone ought to sell them they've got recycled sewage coming out of their drinking water taps in the kitchen.
Well, exactly. But, you know, I suppose, yeah, you need a headline. So it's, I don't think there's any serious obstacle to this one, except, as you say, they haven't actually appointed a contractor yet. So maybe they are doing a bit of due diligence, or I don't know, sort of trying to fight off a bit of opposition locally. But I agree with you.
It could be that the economics don't stack up, because the construction costs have probably gone up by 30% in the past year.
Yes, that's probably true. Yeah, I imagine they've probably got to have a look at the figures again, haven't they? So drought or no drought, I mean, people famously have been comparing the current heat wave, or two heat waves we've had so far this summer, with the summer of 1976, which I can remember quite clearly. And I do remember the hosepipe bans, which were introduced there. My parents' lawn completely died, and the garden turned into a dust bowl. It isn't quite like that. It's shorter and sharper, I think. The 1976 drought was more protracted. And I think the actual lack of water was more serious, certainly in East Kent, where I was living at the time.
Do you know how the government ended that drought? The Callaghan's government, who ended the 76 drought.
Yes, they appointed a...
Very clever move.
Yeah, they appointed a minister of drought.
Yes, Dennis Howell was the minister of sport.
Dennis
at Howell, the time,
that's it, yes.
And they said, right, Dennis, we don't need a minister of sport at the moment. You're now minister for water / drought. I said, all right, I'll do my best. The very next day, it chucked it down.
Oh, that's right. And there were calls for him to immediately be a prime minister, because he obviously is so good at his job. Yeah, I do remember. He became minister of sport, our first minister of sport as well.
No, I think he already was. I think he was minister of sport.
Oh, was he?
Before. I may be wrong. You might be right. It may be the other way around.
I don't know. That's what I remember him for, being the first minister of sport. But anyway, that's... Maybe they ought to do the same thing. I mean, there's going to be a bit of a reshuffle in a few weeks' time, so maybe now's the time. I don't know. So have you got a hose pipe ban where you are, Phil?
Yeah, it came in.
Are you allowed to water your garden?
It came in, when was it? I think last week the hose pipe ban kicked in. We're on a water meter here, so it's always slightly irksome to have a hose pipe running anyway, because you're just watching pounds, shilling and pence running out of the pipe. Much preferred in the days when it was free, in inverted commas. Of course it wasn't, but it's paper in different ways. But no, still, I gave up on my vegetable plot couple of weeks ago. I thought I managed to get most of the beans, and then thought, oh, forget it. Had enough beans anyway.
Well, I was checking because I haven't had any notification through the door or anything like that. But I went on some website which said, put in your postcode and see if there is a hosepipe ban in your area. I put in my postcode and it came up with the Isle of Man. So this particular website got its wires crossed somehow, where incidentally, I believe there is a hosepipe ban. And then I looked a bit further and I discovered that in Northwest Devon, there is a hosepipe ban due to come in towards the end of this month. And I don't know whether I'm in Northwest Devon or Northeast Devon or North Central Devon, because I've never seen that sort of, I've never seen the area broken down into such small parcels. So I don't know whether I'm allowed to use a hose pipe, but rather like you, I'm on a water meter and it really goes against the grain to use tap water to water the garden. I've got a couple of water butts and a 1,000-litre tank to gather runoff, although they're running pretty low at the moment, I've got to say.
I haven't got a 1,000-litre one, but I've got four water butts dotted around, but they long ago were emptied.
Well, anyway,
on that subject, we've had a letter flooding in.
Oh, yes.
From a quantity surveyor called Richard Walker. It says, a simple question from a simple QS of 48 years of experience. He says, if planning authorities were not insisting that rainwater be attenuated on sites, would it not find its way to the rivers, which would then keep adjacent ground damp and provide water for fish and marine life and then top up reservoirs to be treated for human consumption? He's sort of suggesting harvesting rainwater and rainwater attenuation has a downside as well as an upside, which kind of seems,
It's an interesting point, but I think he's wrong. With respect, I mean, he is a construction professional. He's a QS, I have no construction qualifications whatsoever. But I mean, I know that we do have this need, and most local authorities insist in any development that you have some sort of sustainable urban drainage, or they don't call it sustainable urban drainage anymore. It's something, anyway, it's SUDS, but it stands for something else now. But huge underground tanks, which gather, you know, sort of accumulate water running off hard landscaped areas. I mean, the problem, of course, being that you've got a new housing estate or something like that, and you've got lots of parking spaces and roads and stuff like this, and it all runs straight off when you get a heavy rainfall, straight into the local watercourses, causing pollution and flooding and all the rest of it. So you put these big tanks in, and some of them are massive. So the water goes into that and is held temporarily. But the thing is, it's not held there forever. It does find its way into the watercourses eventually, normally through soakaway. And so what Richard Walker is saying is that, you know, surely we should let this water just run straight into the ground and straight into the watercourses to replenish the rivers and all the rest of it. I think the idea is to just control the rate at which it does that. It still does it, but over a longer period of time. So you've got this massive cavity underneath your housing development, just waiting for a downpour, you know, and then it rains, the cavity fills up with water, and then it drains away slowly. And by that time, of course, you hope that the rain has subsided a little or even stopped. And so it flattens the curve, basically. You still get the water running off into the ground, but not all at once. It takes a while to do it. So interesting point, but I don't think it's relevant.
But the attenuation is a flood prevention measure, primarily, I think. And his point is that we've kind of become obsessed by flooding, which, you know, it's predicted to happen every 50 years. These days, it seems to be much more than every 50 years.
Sure.
should we now be thinking that actually drought is potentially a bigger societal risk than flooding?
That's a tough one, but I would probably say not. I mean, if only because we've had a lot of very serious and incredibly damaging floods over the last few years. and only one drought that I can remember since 1976. So drought might become more common, and we might have more droughts because of the changing climate and the fact that we're getting more extremes. Getting windier weather. We're getting colder weather, and we're also getting wetter weather. So why not drier weather at different times of the year as well? And I think that probably we will see a problem. And of course, we've got a growing population, and we have a need to build more houses. So water usage is going to increase. So yes, we do need better and more resilient water resources, and probably, as we've already discussed, more reservoirs to store the water. So drought, I suppose, is going to become more of a problem. It's only inevitable. If we're having more extreme weather, that's going to be one of the extremes.
Have we sorted that one? Do you think we've tackled that one?
I think we have.
I know there's more to talk about on that topic, but tempus fugit. I think we should move on to another topic.
Yes, let's do that. Yeah, I think that's a good idea.
I would like to talk about, I do love getting surveys. I find surveys fascinating for so many reasons, mostly because despite the professional qualifications at the bottom of the, or next to the name of the person or the company who's done it, they always seem loaded with holes and flaws. But there's a particular interesting survey which landed on my desk yesterday, which raised all sorts of questions, which I sent back to the authors, and I've yet to have a reply, or had a holding reply saying, we'll get back to you. Once mm-hmm. they get back to me, I will post something on this on the Construction Index website, and it may be there by the time listeners to this podcast hear us speaking, David, but at the moment I haven't done anything with it. But I do want to talk about it. It is a survey of 2,000 young people between the ages of 18 and 29 years old across the UK on their attitudes towards a career in construction. Do they find it attractive or a turn off? If so, why? If not, why not? And the first thing I read was the press release. The survey was commissioned by NBS, who are the specification platform. It used to stand for National Building Specification, I think, but it is now just NBS. They sponsored it, the way of getting publicity, basically. And I'm not interested. I'm not going to say who did the survey, but a professional survey company. Anyway, the headlines, as far as the press release is concerned, which really got me to read it, construction is now officially an attractive career path for more than half of UK young adults. And they're saying this is a major change. More than 20% of women are now interested in a construction role. Engineers, being an engineer is now the second most wanted job in the UK after healthcare professional. 35% of young people want to be a part of construction. It's an industry undergoing massive positive change, they say. And this whole press release is saying that suggesting that in the past, young people didn't want to go to construction, but now they see it as a dynamic, go-getting, diverse, sexy, high-tech industry that they all want to be part of. And I go, oh, that is a big story. I'm going to look into the detail of this.
Yeah.
Some first very general points to point out. Yes, engineer was the second. They're asked to tick two of these careers that you would like to have. And 13% of the 2,000 respondents had medical/healthcare professional in their top two. 12% had engineer in their top two. But engineer, the word, I would imagine most young people see the word engineer and they're thinking either NASA or Microsoft or Dyson, and aren't necessarily thinking of, the Shard or designing false work and form work for a sewage trench somewhere or something. So what sort, do 12% of these 2,000 young people want to be a construction engineer, or have they got some other sort of engineer in mind? But way down the list of, as a chosen career, becomes skilled trade, brackets, e.g. plumber, carpenter, bricklayer, electrician. Mm-hmm. I say way down, that was still 9%, but every career listed. I mean, the lowest was member of the armed forces, which 5% had as one of their top two career choices. So the spread is only 13% to 5% at the list. So there's not that much difference.
No. But
I mean, social media influencer is above, you know, more people want to be social media influencers than plumbers, carpenters, bricklayers and electricians, which I could believe for 12-year-olds, but for, you know, 18 to 29-year-olds, you would have thought they might have grown up a bit and sort of thinking about getting real.
I mean, I have to say that if nothing else, it makes a change to hear this message, because we're continually bombarded. Well, not bombarded, but it is a sort of a constant complaint that the construction industry is an unattractive environment for school leavers, university graduates and people like that, because of the working conditions and its old-fashioned culture and lack of opportunities for minorities and all the rest of it. And so construction goes around with this millstone of least attractive industry around its neck. And then they come out with this, saying that, you know, more than 50% of people in this age bracket see it as an attractive career, which is great. I mean, if there's even a grain of truth in this, then I think we should applaud it. But I agree with you. I mean, for a start, this word engineer is loaded, because, of course, the chap who comes out to fix a leak in your boiler is referred to as an engineer. He's probably not got an engineering degree. He's a mechanic, a very skilled workman, but not an engineer. Engineers, yeah, you can be a software engineer, you can be a mechanical engineer, an aeronautical engineer. There are so many different engineering professions and careers that equating it exclusively with construction is misleading. I mean, I would say, however, that I would have thought that a number of people in this age group, when asked about a career in the career of an engineer, would probably think of something like the Shard or Tideway or even HS2.
I think it depends who they knew. I mean, if their dad or cousin or mother was an engineer with Microsoft, that they would immediately associate it with that. I mean, you associate these things. I mean, yeah. When I first came across the word engineer, the only engineer I knew was Casey Jones. For younger listeners, he was a very famous train driver in the Wild West.
Yes. Okay, that's fair enough. Well, I grew up with an engineer because my father was an aeronautical engineer. So I, from an early age, I had a good idea of what engineering meant. And my father was one of those people who did get irritated by people calling themselves engineers when they were mechanics. And I've always, because of that, been alert to this anomaly. But I don't know whether or not, getting back to this survey, I think maybe it's over egging the cake, is it, to say that over 50% of young adults?
Let me pick up one question that was asked, which does give a really, really, and I think this is the most encouraging question and answer in the whole survey. Is a question that asked these 2,000 young people, how attractive or unattractive do you consider a career in the construction sector? And they put the caveat there by construction sector. We mean the whole industry, covering from design and constructing buildings, manufacturing construction products, along with other services used to create homes, hospitals, schools, blah, blah, buildings, roads, bridges. So they're talking about the whole supply chain, although I'm not sure how many of the young people being interviewed would understand quite what the supply chain was. But anyway, 24%, virtually one in four, said they found it very attractive. Mm-hmm. 32% said somewhat attractive. So that is a whopping 56%, a clear majority of these young people aged 18 to 29 years old said that a career in construction was either somewhat or very attractive. Now, if 56% of them think it's somewhat or very attractive, how come only 9% have got any interest in being a plumber, carpenter, brickier, electrician, and only 12% have got any interest in being an engineer? And it makes me think, do they all want to work in the social media departments of, you know, the marketing department of Balfour Beatty rather than actually building and designing anything? So while it's hugely encouraging that 56% of young people see it as an attractive career, the other questions don't seem to back that up. So that's one of the questions, one of the things I've asked more information about. And the other thing that this survey doesn't tell me, and I've asked for more information on, is that it's saying, as a matter of fact, that this shows how much things have changed. Well, I kind of feel that way too, but they don't produce the evidence. They haven't got a 2010 survey or even a 2020 survey to say, this is what the answers used to be, and this is where we are now. It's just saying, this is where we are now, and everything we sort of assume, we used to think it used to be different. But unless you've got the data that says what it used to be to compare with the data that you say now, you cannot leap to the conclusion that says things have changed. But it smells like things have changed. I just want more information. Because that's really interesting.
Yeah, you need a benchmark to measure it against. Yes. Otherwise, it's just an opinion, not a fact. Going back to my point about the image of construction traditionally, another thing, apart from it being not a very good environment in which to work, is that it's very out of date. We do things the old-fashioned way. And I've often had emails and press releases from people being quite disparaging about construction's failure to, sort of wake up and smell the coffee and get with the digital age and all the rest of it.
We get those, but those are always from people trying to sell digital products.
Yes.
They're saying no one's using our tech, therefore no one's using any tech.
Well, quite. But then I think, well, what about BIM? What about virtual reality? And what about all the technological developments in, say, the plant sector as well? Yes, I know that when it comes down to it, you're digging holes in the ground and you're building things out of steel and concrete and stone and brick, and digging holes in the ground makes us look like we're sort of back in the Stone Age. Actually, the way we do it proves that we're not.
Yes, the people who complain about the lack of technology are people who are trying to sell different technology to the stuff that we're actually using.
There's an
axe to grind. Going back to this, there was another encouraging stat, and I don't know how this compares to a similar survey from 10 years before might have found, but I'm quite surprised by the statistic. It says, the question asked, thinking back to when you were in school or college, how much information was provided to you about construction careers? Lots, fair amount, not much, nothing, or can't remember. 25% said they were told lots, and 35% said there's a fair amount. Certainly, I was told nothing about a career in construction when I was at school and university in the 80s. I don't know about you. Did you have any careers talk on that? So what are we looking? 60% of people had some or a lot of construction careers advice or information. That seems like a higher number than it would have been not very
back
long
in
ago.
Our day. Yeah,
so that's a good thing. Or maybe just all career guidance is better served than it used to be.
Yeah. I think the other thing is that we talk in general terms about a career in construction, but of course there's a myriad careers in construction. It's a massive industry.
I said before, it's not an industry. It's wrong to think it's a sector.
It's a group of industries. Yeah, it's a sector. Yeah, quite, yeah. And so it's quite different being a design engineer working for somebody like Arup. And being a self-employed brickie working out on site, they are completely different career paths. And I suppose that the site-based careers are perhaps, well, certainly less attractive to the majority of people and attractive to only a minority. Whereas perhaps somebody who's gone to university and got a good degree in physics or engineering will want to go and join Arup's or McDonald or Balfour Beatty or Costain, whoever it is, and have a really fulfilling and exciting career in construction. But it won't be like the bloke who's, a chippy or a brickie out on site. But having said that, I think there is a problem of perception here, because, of course, people, if you're clued up, if you're a good brickie, if you're a good plumber or a good chippy, and you've got a bit of initiative, you can do extremely well. You can run your own business. You can have a good income. You can have a good work-life balance. It's a different career, and it appeals to different people.
Here's the, I suppose when I was at school slash university, and what I came to sort of take as my prejudices afterwards, how I saw things was an architect. To be an architect was highly desirable, took a long time to qualify, mm-hmm. But was creative. You need to be, you know, be good at maths and art and everything and brilliantly creative. And that's a highly desirable thing to be. Being an engineer was, you had to be clever, but you're a bit boring, and it was a boring job, and it's for boring people, but clever people, and a bit, you know, boffin-y.
Yeah.
Didn't have the flair and creativity of architecture. This is the taking them. QSs was for thickos. Thickos became surveyors because you basically just walked down buildings with a tape measure. You did land economy instead of, a proper subject at university. And then the other job, if you couldn't make it as a QS, which was highly attractive, was working for someone like, you know, JCB or Boston Bucyrus as a Southeast Asia sales representative, where you're traveling the world selling multi-million pound shipments of machinery and taking your cut and just going to trade shows around the world and wining and dining customers. And going back to the early days when I first started writing about construction, even not that long ago, quite a lot of the international salesmen for the construction machinery manufacturers were very old school gentlemen who you would never see without polished shoes and a tie, their tie properly tied, and possibly wearing a trilby as well. Yes. There was a very definite type, an old school adventurer, perhaps. Do you see that?
Yeah.
I mean, selling construction machinery, which is not often thought of as a construction job, is particularly if you're doing it on an international level, is it can be quite an attractive thing if you can't cut it at anything else.
Well, sure. I mean, I certainly did meet those people that you refer to. I haven't met any of them for a long time because I haven't been writing about that sector exclusively for a very long time. I can't believe that they're still out there. I mean, there might be a few, you know, very long in the tooth now, but I'm sure that there's a different cohort of people selling construction machinery rather than the old school Thai ones that you mentioned. But yeah, very attractive if you like a lot of travel.
It was almost the last relic of empire. After the empire had gone,
yes.
It was the last sort of vestige of it that you could do.
That's true. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I was in Hong Kong once writing for a magazine about cranes, and I got in touch with a stringer, basically a freelance journalist based out in Hong Kong, a Scottish chap who had offered to write quite a large article for me about the use of, you know, the dockside lifting in the port of Hong Kong. And I arranged to meet him, and I arrived very jet lagged in Kowloon, and checked into my hotel room and sort of flopped down on the bed, looking forward to some sleep, which I'd been deprived of for so long, whereupon the phone went, and it was this Scottish chap downstairs saying, "Hello, Davy, I've come to take you to my club." And I'd forgotten that I was supposed to be meeting him, so I had to rouse myself and go with him. And we went to this expats club in Kowloon, and I say this chap was a journalist. He wasn't really a journalist. He'd been in the sort of dockside machinery industry and was now sort of earning a living here and there by doing this and that. And one of those things was writing about it. And so we went off to this expats club, which was full of Australians, New Zealanders, Scottish, Irish, English people. And it was a bizarre experience because everybody was extremely drunk. And before long, so was my host, so much so that when I couldn't stand it any longer, I had to find my own way back to the hotel and leave this chap carousing with his mates. So that's my sort of abiding memory of that particular aspect of the industry. And I know it's not typical at all, but it stayed with me, that one.
It might not be typical anymore, but I've had similar experiences. I think there's still an international, if you're selling expensive machines, it's not like you're selling something every day. You have to work hard on every single sale. You know, you mainly sell $5 million pieces of equipment, and if you only you sell five a year, you've got to spend months wooing and courting and carousing and schmoozing each prospective lead.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's a different world. But I just want to make one more point before we stop talking about this survey. You mentioned how engineering was considered a little bit nerdy, intelligent but nerdy, and how the creative bit was the architect.
Which is unfair, forgive me, but that's just talking about my 20-year-old self. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. And that was, I think, probably a widespread opinion. The thing which I found surprising about this survey was that 8%, only 8% were specifically interested in an architectural career. And I would have thought that architecture was perhaps one of the more attractive career paths in the construction sector, because after all, you're basically building, if you're Zaha Hadid or somebody like that, you're building a monument to yourself. You're designing this building, and then you can go around and say, I designed that, or you might even say, I built that, even though you hadn't lifted a trowel. I would have thought that architecture would have been one of the more attractive careers. Maybe it's not, because as you pointed out just now, you have to study for 7 years or something like that. You've got to get your professional qualifications. It's not an easy career choice, and there are big, high barriers to entry. But the fact that that makes it appealing to only 8%, I found rather surprising.
But it's a typical British, is it British or is it English? I'm not sure. Thing not to aim high. When I was a young child and first started playing tennis at school, first time I ever played tennis, my mother actually taught me how to play tennis. My dream was to get to Wimbledon to be a ball boy. No American child would have that dream.
Yes.
American children would dream to be in the centre court playing, to be in the final.
Whereas you aspire to be a ball boy.
And I think I had this conversation with friends. I think that's a fairly typical sort of under aspiration of the as I say, I don't know if it's Brits or English, to aspire to be the ball boy, to be adjacent to glory rather than actually.
I think many of us are guilty of that.
Which is kind of what we're doing ourselves now, aren't we? We're adjacent to the glory of construction industry rather than partaking in it. We are merely ball boys.
Yeah, on the sidelines, just kneeling by the net.
So I've achieved my dream.
You have indeed. You have indeed. Let's move on to something else, which is basically a sort of closing out a bit of speculation that we've been bubbling under for a few weeks now. You know what I'm talking about, of course.
I do. This is our sort of any other business. We discussed, I can't remember whether it was earlier this month or last month, but it's...
I think it was last month.
Long ago. It was 28th of April that the board of VP, who... I want to call Viboplant because it's clear who I'm talking about, but they haven't been called Viboplant for a long time. But VP is a group of companies that includes UK Forks, the telehandler hire people, Brandon Hire Station, Ground Force, Torrent Trackside, and various others, all in the sort of non-mobile plant universe. It is stock market listed, majority owned just by a guy called Jeremy Pilkington, who's been chairman for more than 40 years. And the company was set up by his dad. His dad died prematurely. So Jeremy Pilkington has been running the company since he was in his 20s, basically. And he's now in his 70s. And he's basically said in April, end of April, time to sell up. And so they started, the way that stock market companies have to, a formal sale process with, financial advisors coming on board and receiving offers, mulling them. And 3 months later, whatever it is, 4 months later, they've put out a follow-up statement saying, not happening. We haven't received any offers which cut the mustard, so we're not going to do it. And Jeremy Pilkington's going to hang on to his interest in it, standing by it, supporting it. And it's as you were, folks. So the sale of VP is off. Which is interesting, I think.
It is. I mean, rather tantalizingly, I noticed that the chief executive, a chap called Neil Stothart, how do you pronounce his name? Stothard? Forgive me if I pronounced it wrong. But anyway, he said we received a good level of interest throughout the process. I suppose they would, but I just, you know, I mean, it's a big company. It's a very successful company. I'd just like to know who the interest came from. I'd love to know who was sort of giving Jeremy Pinkerton a bell and sort of talking it through and discussing pros and cons. I suppose there'd be a few institutional investors who are interested, not interested in hearing about them and thinking about potential takeover people. And as you speculated at the time, and I thought it was quite an incisive observation that the French company Altrad might be interested because it was a very close match, very good match with VP. But clearly, if he was interested, he wasn't interested enough to make an offer that Jeremy Pilkington could accept.
Well, Altrad, it could be just a question of timing. I still think they're the one that makes sense. But in recent months, Altrad have taken over in the UK, Doosan Babcock, RMD Quickform, that was last year actually, RMD Quickform, mm-hmm. Doosan Babcock, and Sparrows Group, Sparrows Offshore, crane engineering, yep. Offshore people. So that's quite a chunk. And maybe it's just come a year too early. So maybe you know, Altrad might come back. It's just pure speculation. Maybe Altrad don't want to go near it with a barge belt, no idea. But it seems to fit to me, and they've got that appetite for acquisition. I would guess that that competitors of VP might have you know, picked up the phone and gone, go on then, I'll have a look at your books, show us your books.
Yes.
That tends to happen. I mean, you have to sign non-disclosure and all those sort of things, I'm sure. But there might have been some intelligence gathering by competitors. And I'm sure there are always private equity, you know, vulture capitalist people who want to, a company like VP would be manna from heaven for some of these private equity firms,
sure.
who love nothing better than tearing companies apart, you know, ripping them up, rebuilding them, chucking bits.
It's always nice. It's already nicely carved up into chunks, isn't it? You could sell them.
Yes. Yes. They there's lots to play with there. If anyone wants to play with it. And Mr. Pilkington, you know, it's very much, he feels, I'm sure, that it's not his family business quite, but it's his heritage.
It's his baby. It's his family heritage. It is, yes. Yes, absolutely.
And he's been there for a long time, and I bet he is, you know, attached to many of the employees and has a much greater interest in seeing them being looked after and done right by than perhaps other corporate vendors do.
Yeah.
And that was alluded to, I think, in the statement where the sale was called off.
Yeah,
he said the process was focused, this is Jeremy Pilkington, the process was focused on identifying the right owner for the business.
Yeah.
And while we're pleased with the level of interest shown, the sale process, it did not lead to the identification of a suitable new owner.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're not quite our type, dear. I think it was probably the attitude towards the private equity people. Too rough.
Yeah, quite. I mean, I think that shows that, you know, a high degree of responsibility. I mean, I suppose some people, you know, quite happy to sell, you know, obviously sitting on a fortune and would take the money and run. But I would imagine that, as you say, Jeremy Pilkington's been running this business for an awfully long time, and he's built it up. It's very successful. It's not a lame duck. It's not something he'd want to, you know, divest himself of quickly in order to avoid any trouble. It's doing extremely well. So, yeah, obviously he's done the right thing.
Another possibility that we mooted was that the company might be sold to the employees and employee ownership trust. We've talked about this on the podcast many times before. It's a subject we've explored in depth. And it would be quite nice to, from a sentimental, I mean, I'm sentimentally attached to the idea of employee ownership firms. So it may be that could still be emerge as a possibility that is not part of the Citi process somehow. I don't know how you would take a company from stock market listed to employee share ownership, though. I don't know. Maybe, you know, Jeremy Pilkington would have to take it back private first. I don't know.
Well, anyway, so that's off the table now, and presumably it's back to life as normal at VP.
But it sounds like life has always been at normal. He did say that trading had been continuing healthily and as normal all the time. The sale process had been mumbling on in the background. So hopefully it hasn't caused any disruption, but it sounds like it hasn't.
No, I mean, I'm not as au fait with these sort of corporate shenanigans as you are, Phil. But I mean, waving a flag like that, putting a for sale sign notice up over a business, can it have a negative impact on customers, for example?
I don't think you have an immediate negative impact on customers. I think if you have examples, and we've seen it these days more often in football clubs, where you have a slightly semi-detached overseas owner, perhaps from Middle East or North America or whatever, who's there purely as an investor rather than because that's the business they really, really want to be in. And then they decide they don't want to be in that business anymore. That can cause wobbles. I mean, in a football club context, it might be harder for them, if the club's up for sale, it might be harder for them to sign the very top players while their future is uncertain. As to, you know, whether they're going to get a multi-gazillionaire benefactor or someone without such deep pockets. In a business context, I think back to when Costain had its ownership turmoils and financial difficulties and in the not hugely distant past. And I think there was an air of uncertainty over Costain, which the Malaysian owners steadied the ship, but never entirely steadied the ship in terms of shareholder jitters.
Mm.
And so there are occasions where a company being put up for sale can cause disruption. But in an example like this, where you've got a long-standing owner of a good, solid business who's, I'm in my 70s now, we've got to look to the future, let's explore future options.
Fairly logical.
No sense of panic. There's no sense of panic sale there. And the fact that he's chosen to stand by the company when the right buyer hasn't been found adds to that sense of, there's no panic at VP.
Yes. Yeah. Right. So that's that story filed away, at least for the time being. Anything else before we go, Phil?
I can't think. No, I think we're done and dusted.
We are indeed.
Passing mention, the lead story this morning was Balfour Beatty half-year results, which are reasonably solid. All looking good there, which is good news for British construction industry. We'll talk perhaps more about that next time, because I think we're getting close to publication of the Construction Index Top 100 construction contractors, which you've been working on that, haven't you?
Yes, that comes out in a couple of weeks' time, beginning of September. So it'll be ready for us to discuss when we return in a couple of weeks' time. Already there's some quite interesting things coming out of that, so there'll be plenty to discuss there.
Any teasers, any tasters to lure people in?
Well,
I
always find one of the I know it's not by no means the most important element of our top 100 when we look at the top, the 100 largest construction firms. But I'm always interested to read a little section about the construction rich list, which is the people who are earning the most out of construction. And in fact, the person who always comes out on top as the richest person in the construction sector isn't in construction at all. He's in manufacturing, and his name is Lord Anthony Bamford, of JCB fame, of course. But he's actually dropped out of the top 40 on the Sunday Times rich list. No, I think it's a top 40. I haven't got the numbers in front of me. He's still very rich. I mean, he's doing pretty well, but he's not in that elite top 40 anymore.
He's actually spent too much on the Prime Minister's wedding reception.
Oh yes, he hosted that, didn't he?
Checkers was booked. Said, there's a field. But he wasn't actually letting him into the house. He just let them borrow a field at the bottom of the garden. Held his nose. No, I'm sure he did.
Oh, yeah.
Right, well, let's return to the subject of the top 100 and rich people in construction and so on when we return in 2 weeks' time. But
yes,
for another episode of Reconstruction, I've been Phil Bishop and he's been David Taylor. Thank you and goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.